Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kendall Roden, Cynthia Krang, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, Russell Young, and Sajid DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please visit our website at azpodcast.com.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 236, being recorded on the 3rd of July, 2018, with special guest Barry Loubreaks. I'm Sajid, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Cynthia, and of course our special guest Barry, who we'll get to in just a minute. But before we get to him, let's just do a quick roundup on any news. Anything that you guys like, Cynthia and Kale?
Yeah, one to start with on our friend Rob Karen had put out basically this Azure.Source blog post, which is like an all-encompassing kind of roll-up of a bunch of different releases, announcements, all kinds of things. Some of these are around the Gen 2 stuff that we talked about last time with Azure Data Lake and the IoT stuff, but there's other pieces in here about, you know, the Zone Redundant VPN, Express Route Gateways, and things like that. So there's a bunch of different links in there. I'd encourage people to go take a look at them. It's actually quite full. You'll probably spend at least an hour going through there with all those different links, but it touches on not just like product releases, but also like patterns and things going into GA and different events that are coming up. So it's pretty all-encompassing. It's a great post up there.
Very, very, very comprehensive list he maintains, I agree. And he's been doing that for a long time. We work closely with him for the podcast as well. And I like to think of what he does as more like the written version of what we talk about on the podcast. But he does, collect a lot of information and put it together each week. It's really nice. Cynthia, do you have anything?
Yep. So with Microsoft push towards open source, there's actually a lot more integration between Java apps and Azure. So recently, there were two things that came to GA. One is a Maven plugin for Azure App Service. So now you're essentially able to deploy your WAR file to a Azure web app on Linux with the built-in running stack of Java 8 and Tomcat 8.5 or 9. So what that means is you can easily integrate this into your CI/CD pipeline. And in addition to just web apps, there's also an integration of Azure AD support with the Spring Security 5.0. So I thought that was really exciting as the current customer I'm working with right now, they're not only doing .NET, they're also looking to go into Java, and with these different integration points, they don't necessarily have to leave Azure, and because we have all these awesome places where they can still stay on Azure.
That's cool. Nice to hear. You know, we're keeping the push on all these open source frameworks. I use at my customer, we use a lot of event hubs and service bus, and both of these services now offer the VNet service endpoints, which is in public preview. As you know, things like Event Hubs and Service Bus, they are like multi-tenant systems, so you can't really put them inside of your VNet. But what you can do with the VNet service endpoints is to restrict the access to your specific namespaces to a specific VNet in which your applications are running. So this way, you know, you can lock them out from the internet. They're not publicly available. You'll get a 403 if you try to access a specific endpoint or a namespace from the internet, and it will only allow access from your VNet. So that's something that's in preview, and if you use these services, I strongly recommend you look at them, look at that feature, and try it out with your application. Anything else you guys thought was good and interesting?
Two other quick ones. One was the Azure Search, and this is just like a GA thing around synonyms. So people who are using the Azure Search service in order to make that kind of functionality available in your app can take a look at this. Obviously, synonyms are a way to associate equivalent words with what someone's actually searching for in order to get hits. And so essentially that service has been in place for a while, but the general availability of that feature in Azure Search is now out there. So that's awesome. And the other one was around Network Performance Monitor being available in the UK South region. So for our friends across the pond in the UK, this is a basically a cloud-based monitoring solution that allows you to look at like network kind of throughput, latency, these kind of things as you're troubleshooting or working with you know, applications that you're building that integrate with the cloud.
That's very cool. I did have one more. I don't know if Cynthia has any more, but I just, there was one that I had, which is on the video indexer. And I only mentioned it because we, you know, we had a show on video indexer, episode 217. We had a couple of PMs over here on. And, you know, one of the things that you have to do if you index, if you use video indexer, you got to tell it what language your audio is recorded in. But now they have a new feature where you don't have to do that. It will detect the language that you're speaking in the video and will automatically do the, you know, we'll do the capture and the extraction of the text based on that language. I thought that was pretty cool. Anything else before we turn to our special guest? Okay. Well, let's get started then. Hey, Barry, thank you for coming on. You know, he's beat someone on the show before. He's very well known in the Azure space. And Barry, please reintroduce yourself to our listeners, and then we'll jump on a couple of topics so we can talk about.
All right. Thank you. So thank you for having me again. I'm Barry Luybrechts. I'm from the Netherlands, and I am an independent developer and architect, and I always say with a passion for the cloud, because I like working in the cloud, and so far I get to do that a lot, so that's very good. I do consulting for people, and I also create Perl-side courses, mostly around Azure, but also around other bits, around HTML, WebAssembly is one coming up, and I get to help with some of the ebooks. From Microsoft, like for instance, the Developer's Guide for Azure and the Quick Start Guide for Azure for .NET developers. And other things regarding the Azure marketing team, I help with blog posts and stuff. So that's all very cool stuff that I get to do. I'm very lucky that I get to do that.
Yeah, and I know you also, do you have your own show or own podcast? You do that as well, or...
No, not yet. That just sounds like a lot of work.
It is. It does. It is sometimes. Yes, but I know. So you did the Pluralsight courses, and that must be, you know, that's something that you've been doing for a while, right?
Yeah. Since end of 2016, basically, the first one came out, and I've been doing it ever since. And it's still a lot of fun, and it gets easier a little bit, at least the production parts, not the actual research and. Creating the content, but yeah.
Now your the area that you're most passionate about is applications, I think, right? Running apps in Azure. That seems to be the area that you focus on quite a bit. So give us like what have you been doing recently in that area? Give us a feel for some of the apps that you could have been working on for your customers. Of course, we don't have to know the names of the customers or anything that's not public information.
No, definitely. Definitely. I am usually in the developer space or the app developer space. So not so much the IT pro space. And usually what I gravitate towards is app services, because that's easy and it provides a lot of value. So for instance, we now have a customer that just runs a web application with app services. They use Azure Web Apps, for instance. Together with Azure Functions to do some background processing and even some APIs that you expose through Azure Functions, because you can also provide an API layer basically over a couple of Azure Functions, which is very cool, because then you have an API endpoint that's just handled by Azure Functions. And all those things are very easy to use, because you can deploy very easily to it using things like Visual Studio Team Services, and you can do almost zero downtime deployments with deployment slots, for instance, which are in web apps, mobile apps, API apps, function apps, and it's just ingrained in there. So what that does is, go ahead.
No, I was going to. I wanted to just ask you for just a minute. You mentioned APIs in two contexts just now. You said APIs using functions, and then again, there's API apps. Why would you? What decision point would go into figuring out? Okay, I need to run my API in functions as opposed to API apps.
Yeah, well, API apps. That's actually a special one. Because as of, I think it was November of 2015, there's actually no difference between a web app, app services web app, and an app services API app. Previously, an API app was different and unique because it has cross-origin resource sharing, a security feature, and also a feature to share its API definition, but all those things are now also in web app. So if you want to run an API in app services, I always say use a web app instead of an API app.
But, I wonder why have they still maintained that? I wonder why Microsoft still maintained that separate.
That is a great question.
Just for historical purposes, maybe?
Probably. I've asked around, and one PM said to me, well, it is a different icon in the Azure portal. Which it is, so that you can see, well, this is an API and this is a web app. So, yeah.
Okay.
But, so, you know, I totally expect those things to be merged or something, so that you just have a web app and a mobile app and functions.
But why would you decide to use functions or web apps for an API? Let's take APIs as an example.
Yeah. Well, I think if you have an API which has which you don't know which methods it's going to have, which is probably always the case, and you just start out with one thing, one let's say background task that you just want to expose as a webhook or something to the world, then a function is a very good place to start. You know, because you don't know if you're ever going to have more methods to do so. It's a good place to start. And also a function can run serverless. And what that means is that when you call that function, it runs and then it goes away basically, and you only pay for that execution of it. Where if you run your API in a web app, you pay for having it around all month. So that thing is always on, let's say, where an API in a function app would only run when it's actually called, which is very cheap.
So it sounds like if I know my workload is like a very pointed stateless type call that I need to do, I might gravitate towards functions. And if I have something that needs to maybe have some cache, or you know, when it fires up, I keep some stuff running around for a while, maybe I would gravitate towards the API app. Is that true?
The first one, yes. So when you have something that just runs occasionally, let's say, I would gravitate to a function app. If you need some state, then I would also not recommend to actually store that state within a web app, because a web app itself is also something that's volatile. For instance, if you scale out, what happens then? You know, you can't rely on the virtual machine that runs beneath it. And Azure also takes care of all that stuff automatically. So if that virtual machine falls away for whatever reason, then your state might also be gone. So state should always be somewhere else, like in an external Redis cache or in Azure Storage, for instance. So you could also use that with a function app. You could also have state there in Redis cache or in Azure Storage.
Makes sense.
So yeah, the differentiator would then be, do you run your the code that you want to run, does that run occasionally, let's say once a month or maybe not at all, versus I know that this thing is going to be called every hour for five times, let's say, and I'm okay with paying for that the whole month.
So even thinking about it, I didn't even think about that, but like from an economy standpoint, saying I only infrequently do this thing, so it's cheaper for me to just pay on the per call basis, where like if I'm saying, no, I'm going to call this like constantly, I'll just pay for a web app because it's going to be hanging around here anyhow and I'm going to be calling it a bunch of times. That's interesting, yeah.
And then if you look at, let's say, the abstraction level, so a web app, to me, that's platform as a service. And a function app, which is serverless, I call that logic as a service. So that's an abstraction level higher, where in a web app, you still need to configure scaling. So you need to configure scaling rules. Let's say if the CPU hits 80%, put in another instance, or then scale up to a higher pricing tier. Where in the next abstraction level, so logic as a service, so function app, you don't have that. Those things scale automatically. So you don't configure it, they scale automatically. So that's another point.
Now, when you said logic as a service, I immediately thought of logic apps. How does this fit into the whole equation?
It's just a term that I use, you know. People call it serverless, but I call it logic as a service because basically you always have servers, of course. So I find that a pretty silly name. But these are just small pieces of code or logic, like a logic app, for instance, a small piece or a complete process that you execute as a service, basically. So you expose those small pieces of code or small processes as a service. That's how I think about that.
But when would you use, say, functions versus logic apps? Like what would trigger you to go one way or another?
That's great. So for those who don't know what a logic app is, first of all, you should definitely use those because those are awesome and I think probably underutilized by a lot of people. A lot of customers that I talk to don't know what they are, and what they are orchestration engines. So when you create a new logic app, you get to pick a starting trigger, and that could be, for instance, a timer trigger, so run every 5 minutes or every hour, or it could be based on an external event, like when a tweet goes out or when a new message in my inbox comes into my inbox, or a new item in a SharePoint list, then run this logic app. And then from there, you can create a whole process within that logic app where you basically call APIs of connectors that might already exist. Microsoft Logic Apps provides many pre-made connectors to things like Office 365, Twitter, Salesforce, SAP, you name it. And you can also create your own, of course. And it's just a great service to relatively easily click together a complex business process, basically. So where a logic app you use when you have multiple steps in a process a lot of times, where a function app usually just does one thing. So a function app has an input and a trigger. So for instance, again, I get a new message in my email box, might trigger a function app. In the function app, then I do something with that email and output it somewhere, and then it's done. So that's just one step versus a logic app that has multiple steps. And now to make it a bit more complicated, you might say, well, function apps also has a framework. Oh, geez. That's called durable functions. That has gone generally available just a while back. And that kind of enables that scenario of logic apps as well. So you can then orchestrate and tie together different function apps and keeps the state, so the input and the output of the logic apps, together and tie that all into a nice process there. So that has kind of the same functionality.
And then the logic apps, is that also comes under the serverless banner?
Yeah, definitely. So that's the same thing. So it scales automatically, and you only pay for when it runs.
Very nice. Now, it just sound like logic apps is a lot more enterprise friendly, right? It's got all those enterprise hooks, connections. I think it can do things like DFS authentication, so you could connect it to your on-premises systems and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also basically the Azure equivalent of BizTalk, where you previously also had BizTalk services in Azure. That's now gone away. And now, if you do anything orchestration-wise, you should look to logic apps there.
So it sounds like if I was building an application, let's say, and I know, so at the leaf level, I'm basically creating an API or maybe a function app that's going to do some work for me, and then I can go up. It feels like logic apps goes up a step for me. Then I can say, now as part of my business workflow, I need to do these three things, and I'm going to use these new things that I build over here, like this API app or this function that I build over here. Is that a common model you see where like they're like building blocks building on each other?
Yeah, absolutely. So like you also mentioned there, you can use your APIs that you host in a web app or your function app in a logic app. So those are steps that you can use within a logic app. So the logic app is basically the overarching thing that ties all of those other things together. Yeah.
Go ahead, Cynthia.
No, sorry. Is there ever a case where customers starts with, oh, these are the Azure services we want to use, and how do we design our application so that we can best utilize all the different benefits?
Yeah, that happens way too often. Which I don't like, because people get into then Azure because they saw something somewhere and they say, well, this is such a cool service, we should find some business use for it.
It's like going into a candy store, you know, you want everything.
Exactly. Yeah, but obviously it should go the other way around. You know, you have you have a requirement or a business use case, and then you should try and find the best fit within Azure or even another platform for that. But yeah, that definitely happens, and that happens a lot. And usually what ends up happening is that it doesn't fit really well, and then you have to either convince them to use another service or just, you know, squiggle it in there and make it work somehow. Yeah.
So when you do hear them have this conversation with you, what do you tell them, or where do you try to point them to really think about their business requirements first before jumping right into what Azure has to offer?
Well, that's what I then try to do. So I try to question deeper, because they usually then stay very superficial about their requirements, because, you know, they just think that whatever this thing can do are our requirements. But then if you dive a little bit deeper with the customer, they usually find out themselves that the requirements are different than they actually thought. You know, how are the users going to use that thing then? And what's the value of what you're trying to build here? And usually when you start talking price, then people start looking a bit harder into this, because then they realize, well, this is all fun, but it's going to cost me an arm and a leg to actually do this. And then I have this fun service that really doesn't fit my customer needs. So yeah, but it's a difficult conversation always, really, to get customers to the point where they first think about the business requirement and then about the technology that can maybe fill in those requirements.
Thank you.
You know, Barry, one thing that I've been trying to wrap my head around, especially recently now, that app services, since you mentioned it, you know, there's not there. You have so many choices. You have the Windows version, you have the Linux version, and you can run containers or non-containers. My head keeps spinning when I see all these choices. How do you, kind of resolve this for your customers? Like, what is the thought process that goes into your mind as you try to design something for your customers there?
Well, that is very difficult because there are so many options, and that's in my mind because of Microsoft and Azure want to make sure that everybody can use the cloud, no matter where you come from or what ecosystem you're used to, Linux or containers or straight up platform as a service. So what I try to do is drill down into it with a couple of questions, like, for instance, how much control do you need as a customer? Like, do you need control over the operating system or not? Or a bit less, do you need control over scaling or not? And that kind of filters all those services already. Because if you do need control over the operating system, then you're looking at virtual machines, containers, infrastructure as a service services. And otherwise you go up the stack. And then other questions I would ask are, for instance, where do you need your application to run? As in only in Azure, or potentially also in Amazon, let's say, or in Google. There are customers, big customers, I luckily never have one yet, that do multi-cloud development, just to make sure that if one of the clouds falls out, then they have their disaster recovery covered. But that's an important question, and sometimes they want to run hybrid as well, as in whatever I create here, let's say a function for my function app, I want to be able to run that in Azure, but I also want to run that on-premises or on my IoT device, let's say. And then you narrow down the options a bit more. And then there's another question, for instance, what usage model do you need? And then we go into what we just talked about, as in, should it be always on? Is it something that runs always, or is it something that runs occasionally, or potentially as a background task, just at night, let's say, or only when it's used, like a function is a good fit for that, for instance. Maybe it's never used and then you don't pay anything. Maybe it's used a lot and then you pay a little bit more because they're very cheap. But with these questions, then I try to narrow down which options are available and then try and choose from there based on the actual requirements. So then you're going to fill in the gaps with the requirements that you have there. And ultimately also look at what is the customer used to, you know, is it a Linux shop? Well, then you're probably not going to go for Windows, for web app Windows. So yeah, that's kind of the process.
That's good. No, that's a very, very good answer there. I mean, I've been doing some work with Kubernetes recently with AKS, and just curious on your thoughts. You know, what do you see with customers? How does that application platform play into the overall decision matrix?
I just recently got into containers with a customer. I tended to stay away from it because, in my opinion, it's still infrastructure as a service, Because yes, it's a container and it's all handy and fast, but it's still an operating system that you need to make sure that it's the latest version, the image that you have there. And there are many, many, many options to run containers in Azure, including web apps. You have container service or Kubernetes service, which was container service, container instance, batch even runs containers, web apps for containers, Service Fabric is also a container orchestrator. But Kubernetes has gotten a lot of attention lately, as it has gone GA as well, which is very cool. And I think that's usually the place to start for people, especially now it is a managed service, because back when it was a container, the container service called the container service was a bit more complicated. You had more choices, let's say, as in which orchestrator do I want to use, DCOS or Kubernetes. And now it's a bit more laid out, and also you seem to have less control, let's say, over the VMs that it runs on, because that's all a bit more abstracted away as it is managed. But still, if you want to, obviously, you can go to that VM set and change things out. But Kubernetes, in my opinion, is really, if you need a larger scale container service that also does orchestration, so spins up containers when they die, scales up containers, and does a communication between containers, which is actually a pretty complicated thing. But it is also pretty young still. The tooling around Kubernetes is relatively young, and it's changing a lot as well. So it demands a lot of customers. And a recent customer that was trying to get into that had some bits of trouble with that, to get their developers up to speed on this, as they were also previously platform as a service developers, so they were used to web apps and all that stuff. And now when you use containers, you immediately go to the command line, and you have to dive a little bit deeper, let's say. So I'm totally expecting that the tooling will evolve, which it always does, which makes it a lot easier to do things visually and from Visual Studio with just a couple of clicks of a button, like we're used to from web apps and such. But currently it's a lot of, let's say, manual work that you still need to do, and with a relatively high learning curve there. So it's not that straightforward or trivial to get into there. So to get into containers, what we first did with this customer was to start with container instances, because you can also run a container there, but you don't need an orchestrator to use that. You can couple it to Kubernetes service, but you don't need to. You can just run it and then just experiment with it and see what happens, scale it and such. And then you can graduate to Kubernetes there. That's how we did it for that customer.
I think that's a good approach. The whole DevOps mentality has to be different when it comes to containers, and the customers need to wrap their head around that first before diving into that. It's a good approach. Great discussion so far, Barry. I just want to see if Cynthia and Cale have any more questions that we can talk about here.
I think this was great. I really appreciate you coming on here, Barry, and sharing some of your insights as you're out there working with customers, and kind of the flow or the mentality that you're going through when you're approached with, you know, we have all these services and all these different ways to basically run compute in the cloud. Yeah. How do I do it? It's a hard question to answer. So big props to you for taking on that challenge, and really helpful, these insights you've shared here.
Yeah, not a problem. I love doing this stuff, and it's obviously part of my job. Just as a note, all of these nuggets, let's say this whole process and what to use when, are also in the Developer's Guide to Azure, which is a free Microsoft ebook that I've created together with Michael Crump, who also works for Microsoft. And there's a new version coming out on that, the third edition. We're working on that now. And you can reach that through aka.ms/devguide. We'll probably put something in the show notes as well.
Yep, we'll certainly do that. Yeah, I remember when you had the second edition out, we had put a link to that and talked about it on the show at the time. So great to see you continuing, you and Michael continue working on that book. All right, well, Barry, appreciate you coming on, and I'm sure we'll get you on for a third time sometime in the future when there's new services to talk about.
Quantum as a service. When there we have go. That, we'll bring you on.
Yeah, when's that coming out? Do you know anything?
We're not saying. No, I'm just kidding. All right, Barry, Cale, Cynthia, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.